Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A UN aid convoy reached northwest Syria on Thursday for the first time since the devastating earthquakes cut off supply lines from Turkey 3 days ago. The UN Migration Agency, IOM, reported that 6 trucks carrying shelter items including blankets and hygiene kits reached Bab al-Hawa, the only UN Security Council border crossing authorized for aid deliveries. The development came as UN Special Envoy for Syria, Geert Pedersen, called for assurances that desperately needed assistance inside Syria would not be held up or politicized.
We need aid, life-saving aid. It's desperately needed by civilians wherever they are, irrespective of borders and boundaries. We need it urgently through the fastest, most direct, and most effective routes. They need more of absolutely everything.
Speaking later in New York, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres emphasized that it was essential to put people first and provide greater access for humanitarians, calling on the international community to provide more resources to meet these staggering levels of need. Syria is divided into areas under the control of the government, opposition forces, and other armed groups. Government and opposition areas have been devastated by the earthquake tragedy. Before the disaster, 15.3 million people in Syria needed humanitarian assistance, and that massive number will now have to be revised upwards, aid teams have warned. Malawi is in the grip of the deadliest cholera outbreak in the country's history, the UN Health Agency, WHO, said on Thursday. To help tackle the disease, which causes acute watery diarrhea that can kill within hours if not treated, the World Health Organization has distributed cholera kits and other supplies, including oral rehydration salts, IV fluids, antibiotics, rapid diagnostic test kits, personal protective equipment, tents, and cholera beds in affected districts. The UN agency has also helped to provide nearly 50 hydration points in vulnerable communities. Much more help is needed, though, according to the WHO, which has supported the recruitment of dozens of doctors, nurses, and clinical technicians across the country. Across Africa, cholera cases are surging exponentially. Cases on the continent in January were 30% higher than for the whole of last year. In addition to Malawi, Mozambique and Zambia have also reported cases of cholera recently. So too have Ethiopia, Kenya and Somalia amid a prolonged and harsh drought that's left millions in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Cholera infections have also been confirmed in Burundi, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Nigeria. Italy's criminalization of charities that rescue migrants stranded at sea must end, a leading independent human rights expert said on Thursday. The comments by Mary Lawler, special rapporteur on the situation of human rights defenders, came ahead of the trial of civil society crew members in Sicily. Ms. Lawler, who reports to the UN Human Rights Council, maintained that the proceedings against search and rescue NGOs were a darkening stain on Italy and the EU's commitment to human rights. Preliminary criminal proceedings began last May against 21 people in Trapani, Italy, including 4 members of the Juventus search and rescue crew and human rights defenders from other civilian vessels for alleged collaboration with people smugglers. They are being charged with aiding and abetting unauthorized immigration. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
For radio as secular as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We talk about why Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders' views are, to quote her, crazy and wrong.
Then we're joined by TYT investigative reporter Jonathan Larson
to talk about his amazing reporting on the National Prayer Breakfast and the Family Feud.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from Monday's massive earthquakes in Turkey and Syria has passed 22,000, with the numbers exponentially increasing as pressure mounts on the United Nations to provide urgent aid to northwestern Syria, which was already in dire need of humanitarian assistance due to 12 years of civil war and international sanctions. Aid groups have escalated demands on Turkey's government to allow in more cross-border aid and are warning of a secondary disaster amidst worsening conditions in rebel-held areas of northern Syria. Meanwhile, authorities in the hardest-hit regions of Turkey have begun burying the dead in mass graves. This is a survivor near the epicenter of one of Monday's two largest quakes.
The gravity of the event is very deplorable, doomsday itself. There are thousands of injured and dead. You see, these are graves that are being newly opened. We've already started to bury people here. Believe me, there's no family left without pain. Most people don't even know what to do. We don't know what will happen.
Former Vice President Mike Pence has received a legal summons from Jack Smith, the special counsel overseeing criminal investigations into former President Trump. The subpoena reportedly seeks documents and testimony related to Trump's bid to overturn the 2020 presidential election, culminating in the January 6 attack on the Capitol. It's not clear whether Pence will comply with the subpoena or if he'll invoke claims of executive privilege. In Mississippi, a supermajority of white Republicans in the state House of Representatives has approved a bill to establish a separate court system and an expanded police force within the city of Jackson, which is 80% African American. If the legislation becomes law, it'll place Mississippi's public safety commissioner, who is currently white, in charge of an expanded Capitol Police force in Jackson. Local judges would be handpicked by Mississippi's Supreme Court Chief Justice, who is white, and prosecutors and public defenders would be selected by the state attorney general, who is also white. Voters in every other county court system in Mississippi elect judges and prosecutors. After viewing Tuesday's debate in the Mississippi House Gallery, Jackson Mayor Chokwe Antar-Lumumba reportedly said, "It reminds me of apartheid." Meanwhile, black lawmakers in Missouri are accusing Republicans of racism after House Speaker Dean Plocker, who is white, silenced African-American State Representative Kevin Windham during a floor debate Thursday. Windham was debating a bill that would allow the governor to appoint a special prosecutor in regions with high homicide rates. He was interrupted while reading from a Mississippi Today article about the disenfranchisement of black voters in Jackson, Mississippi.
Mississippi's legislature is thoroughly controlled by white Republicans who have redrawn districts.
Gentlemen, please state your point of order.
The gentleman is talking about Mississippi issues, and we're talking about House Bill 301 that's here in Missouri. If he could please stay on topic, I'd appreciate it.
After State Representative Kevin Windham continued discussing the Mississippi legislation, the House Speaker cut his microphone and ended debate on the bill. The aggressive move prompted outrage among black lawmakers, including Missouri Legislative Black Caucus Chair Marlene Terry.
There's a lot of racism going on here. It's racist to not allow him to speak. We have to have permission to ask questions on the floor. There's a list that has to go around. You know, we're trying to work with them, and it's not working out.
This comes after Missouri Republicans recently approved bills limiting public education about race, criminalizing drag shows, adopting a stricter dress code for women lawmakers, and blocked a proposed ban on children carrying guns in public without adult supervision. The Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives voted Thursday to overturn two Washington, D.C. bills. One would allow non-U.S. citizens to vote in local D.C. elections. The other overhauls the city's criminal code. 42 Democrats joined Republicans in their vote. Eleanor Holmes Norton, D.C.'s non-voting representative, said there's, quote, never justification for Congress nullifying legislation enacted by the district.
I can only conclude that the Republican leadership believes that D.C. residents, the majority of whom are black and brown, are either unworthy or incapable of governing themselves.
In other news from Washington, D.C., police arrested and charged a suspect after the assault of Minnesota Congressmember Angie Craig in the elevator of her apartment building Thursday morning. Her office said she's physically okay after the assault, in which she defended herself by throwing hot coffee on the assailant. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is meeting with President Biden at the White House today in Lula's first official visit to the United States since his inauguration as president on New Year's Day. The two leaders are expected to discuss threats to democracy, human rights, the environment, and Brazil's efforts to protect the Amazon. Reuters reports the U.S. government is considering joining the Amazon Fund, which fights deforestation of the Brazilian Amazon. Lula is also scheduled to meet with Democratic members of Congress, Senator Bernie Sanders, and representatives of the AFL-CIO. Lula's joined by several of his cabinet members, including Environment Minister Marina Silva, who is expected to meet with Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry, and Brazil's new Minister of Racial Equality, Aniele Franco, the sister of the murdered Rio de Janeiro council member, racial justice activist Marielle Franco. This comes as Brazil's federal police announced Friday they've launched an operation targeting illegal miners in the Yanomami indigenous territory, where communities are facing a humanitarian catastrophe, largely due to the disastrous effects of illegal gold mining, which have displaced people, devastated the land, and contaminated rivers and whole communities with mercury. The Nicaraguan government Thursday released over 200 political prisoners, including student and human rights activists and political opponents critical of President Daniel Ortega. The freed prisoners immediately went into exile after the U.S. government chartered a plane from the capital, Managua, and flew them to Washington, D.C. Two declined to leave Nicaragua, including a Roman Catholic bishop who reportedly said he preferred to remain a prisoner rather than go into exile. Among those released was Evelyn Pinto, a human rights defender who was sentenced to 8 years in prison last year after she was arrested in 2021 during Ortega's crackdown on dissent ahead of that year's presidential election when he was reelected for a fifth term. This is Pinto's daughter speaking from Dulles International Airport Thursday as she waited for her mother's arrival.
My mother is someone who has fought for democracy in Nicaragua, for the rights of children, teenagers, and indigenous peoples. She was unjustly detained by the dictatorship, just like the rest of the political prisoners, on November 6, 2021.
In Uganda, five activists were arrested Thursday as they protested the government's decision to close the country's UN Human Rights Office. The activists were from the group Torture Survivors Movement Uganda and said without the UN agency's presence, they felt helpless in the world against actions by the government of Yoweri Museveni. This comes just months after a UN committee said Ugandan forces regularly committed human rights abuses, including torture, excessive use of force, and arbitrary detention. Longtime activist, writer, and beloved baker Jen Angel has died at the age of 48. She owned the popular community-based Angel Cakes in Oakland, California. She was a pioneering force in independent media, a co-founder of Clamor Magazine, an agency, an anarchist media organization. She was also a longtime organizer of the Bay Area Anarchist Book Fair. Jen Angel was actively involved in anti-war and anti-capitalist struggles through the years, including Occupy Wall Street. She died after she was critically injured in a violent robbery in Oakland earlier this week. In a statement, Angel's family and friends wrote, quote, "We know Jen would not want to continue the cycle of harm by bringing state-sanctioned violence to those involved in her death or to other members of Oakland's rich community. As a longtime social movement activist and anarchist, Jen did not believe in state violence, carceral punishment, or incarceration as an effective or just solution to social violence and inequality," unquote. Jen Angel's family has asked traditional prosecution be avoided in her case and alternatives such as restorative justice be employed instead. And David Harris has died at the age of 76. A key leader of the draft resistance movement of the 1960s, Harris actively encouraged young people to resist being conscripted into the Vietnam War. He served 20 months behind bars for his own draft refusal. He spent four of those months in solitary confinement for organizing prisoner protests demanding humane conditions. Joan Baez, his wife at the time, wrote a song for David while he was in prison. David Harris died of lung cancer on Monday at his home in Mill Valley, California. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is our secular Valentine to you.
And I'm Dan Barker. You can probably tell from my voice that I'm fighting a head cold. I feel great, but my voice is just kind of, laryngitis. So I would ask listeners to please not pray for me today. This is the February 9th, 2023 edition of Free Thought Radio. Again, Grant Blaschka with Audio for the Arts is our engineer in the Stephen Uhl Friendly Atheist Studio in Freethought Hall, the national offices of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
Freethought Radio, as regular listeners know, is a weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which has surpassed 40,000 members in the last month. If you are a new member, thank you. If you're current longtime member, thank you. And we would love to send you information by mail or email about the Freedom From Religion Foundation. If you click on the Ask for Info link at ffrf.org, we'll send you a copy of our lively 24 or 28-page newspaper, Free Thought Today, and a brochure about our 45-plus years of achievements in keeping religion out of government and educating the public, that's you, about non-theism.
Today, we're going to talk with Jonathan Larson. He's the managing editor of the Young Turks. We're going to talk about his recent articles investigating the National Prayer Breakfast. We talked about this on the show last week, but Jonathan Larson has a lot more detail about why and how the National Prayer Breakfast is now scaling back after a lot of criticism.
And of course, it's not an official government entity, but they tried to make it look like that, put on by that shadowy right-wing Christian group called The Family.
And before that, we are going to talk with Madison, Wisconsin's running man on our own, who is our own FFRF attorney, Chris Lyne. We'll talk about the feature story about Chris that ran this week in the Wisconsin State Journal.
And we'll also talk about some of his many achievements as an intake attorney writing complaint letters and getting victories. On our TV show, Free Thought Matters, this week I spoke with a brave city council woman from Osceola, Michigan, Emily Olson, who refused to say the opening prayer, well, who complained about the opening prayer and refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
And we talked with Emily Olson on this show a couple of weeks ago. During the Free Thought Matters TV interview, Annie Laurie asked Emily a question.
Why didn't you stand up for the pledge?
Contrary to popular opinion from this person, I am not anti-American. That's not why I didn't stand. I just didn't stand because I feel like the insertion of the words under God really tried to, in the 50s, turn something that was meant to be a unifying gesture that people could make to kind of show their support for their country. And I think it tried to turn Christianity into a national identity at the same time. And so because that was added in the 50s, ever since high school, I've always just opted out of saying the Pledge of Allegiance because while I can't change it, you know, it's not as though I'm in a position where I can unwind that language. I can abstain from it. So that's the best that I can do.
And so you'll be pleased to know that Emily Olson is going to be receiving FFRF's Nothing Fails Like Prayer Award at our upcoming convention, the 40 6th annual convention in Madison, Wisconsin on the weekend. Well, actually Friday the 13th of October and Saturday the 14th of October. And so she'll be joining our lineup, including Washington Post contributing writer Kate Cohen and secular legislators, and there'll be a lot more to announce soon. You can watch that episode of Free Thought Matters right now on Free Thought Matters playlist on FFRF's YouTube channel.
And if you live in one of the 13 major cities where Free Thought Matters is broadcast on local television, you can watch that show every Sunday morning. For stations and times, check ffrf.org/Free Thought Matters, or go to our website and under the news drop-down, look for Free Thought Matters.
And in terms of, before we go to the news, and there's a lot of it, I do want to say happy birthday to Charles Darwin, coming up February 12th. He was born 1809, the same day, the same year as Abraham Lincoln. And Frederick Douglass, who adopted Valentine's Day as his birth date. He was born into slavery and did not know his birth date, and it's estimated his birth year was 1818. Now, in terms of news, I don't know if you watch the Grammys. I don't normally, but I was very pleased to see that they had a new category for social change, and the winner was Shervin Hajipour for the best song. It's called Balrari, and we're going to play some of it, but because it's in Persian, I will translate first. I'll say some of the words. Barare actually means for or because of in Persian. For dancing in the alleys, for the fear when kissing, for my sister, your sister, our sisters, for changing rusted minds, for the shame of poverty, for the regret of living an ordinary life, for the dumpster diving children and their wishes, for this dictatorial economy, for this polluted air, for Valiasar and its worn-out trees, for Piruz and the possibility of his extinction, for the innocent band stray dogs, for the unstoppable tears, for the scene of repeating this moment, for the smiling faces, for students and their future, for this forced heaven, for the imprisoned elite students, for the Afghan kids, for all these fours that are beyond repetition, for all of these meaningless slogans, for the collapse of fake buildings, for the feeling of peace, for the sun after these long nights, for anxiety and sleeping pills, for men, homeland, prosperity, for the girl who wished to be a boy, for women, life, freedom, for freedom, for freedom. It is the protest song of the pushback against the Iranian revolution. It's the revolution being led by women, with the cry, Women, Life, Freedom. So let's listen to a little bit of it.
برای توی کوچه رخصیدن، برای ترسیدن به وقت بوسیدن، برای خواهرم، خواهرت، خواهرامون، برای تغییر مفها که پوسیدن، برای شرمندگی، برای بیپولی، برای حسرت یک زندگی معمولی، برای کودک زبال گرد و آرزوهاش، برای این اقتصاد دستوری، برای این هوای آلوده، برای ولیت رو درختای فرسوده، برای پیروز و احتمال انقراضش، برای سگهای بیگناه ممنوعه، برای گریه های بیوقفه، برای تصویر تکرار این لحظه، برای چهره ای که میخنده، برای دانش آموزا، برای آینده، برای.
So you can find that online, of course, and he is in danger of arrest, as so many tens of thousands have been detained or
endangered. He was so pleased to know that his song would be chosen.
And he said he wept when he learned.
For freedom, for freedom, for freedom.
And woman, life, freedom. So there's a lot of news, and I do want to highlight a new study that came out from our friends at PRRI. And they just did a study. It's a major study, PRRI and Brookings Christian Nationalism Survey, where they talked to 6,000 Americans. And the good news from it shows that Americans strongly, overwhelmingly reject Christian nationalism. Up to half to two-thirds of Americans reject Christian national precepts. And even a third of Americans who say they've never heard the term Christian nationalist had a negative view of the term once they were exposed to it. But this survey does show the extremist views of those who sympathize with or are considered adherents of Christian nationalism, finding they are 7 times more likely to support political violence. So after January 6th, this is of concern. Those who are over 50 are white evangelicals, Republicans, and lack a college degree are most apt to favor Christian nationalist statements. But the good news is that by a margin of 2-1, Americans reject this Christian nationalist idea that God intended America to be a new promised land for European Christians to dominate. But they did find, of course, Christian nationalists agreed with that, and they're also tending to be anti-immigrant and support QAnon and deny that white supremacy is a problem. But in terms of rejection of Christian nationalist views, 50% of Americans completely disagree with the statement that the U.S. government should declare America a Christian nation. When you add those who mostly disagree, it's almost two-thirds of Americans. Similarly, rejected is U.S. law should be based on Christian values, or if the U.S. moves away from Christian foundations, we will not have a country anymore. Two-thirds disagree or mostly disagree with the idea that being Christian is an important part of being an American. And likewise, they reject or mostly reject the statement, God has called Christians to exercise dominion over all areas of American society. And we do have a press release up analyzing more of this mostly good news, but some of the nuance that is cause concern. And we do have to say that there is a clear threat still with Christian nationalism, especially since so many of them, unfortunately, may be our governors or sitting in our capitals or on some of our Supreme Court or other federal benches.
Or some candidates. What does Sarah Huckabee Sanders think about Christian nationalism?
Well, of course, she did the rebuttal to Biden yesterday, and she made bizarre statements, and let's just listen to her first.
Most Americans simply want to live their lives in freedom and peace, but we are under attack in a left-wing culture war we didn't start and never wanted to fight. Every day we are told we must partake in their rituals, salute their flags, and worship their false idols, all while big government colludes with big tech to strip away the most American thing there is. Your freedom of speech.
And then actually she went on to say, that's not normal. It's crazy and it's wrong. Well, I'm sorry. I don't think that her views are normal. They're crazy and they're wrong. And I do a blog. You can find it up at our website, but where I do kind of dissect, come on, the people who are trying to force rituals and flag salutes in worshiping their false idols are the Christian nationalists, not, as she says, the leftists. But, of course, when they're talking about we don't want to indoctrinate our children in schools, unfortunately, they're not talking about keeping religion out of our schools. They're talking about you can't even mention, you know, the Don't Say Gay movement or what they call critical race theory, which really isn't taught in the lower levels. But they don't want any acknowledgement of racism. That's racist. And so very bizarre.
Notice how she says we are being attacked. As if real Americans were those white Christian Americans.
Well, and yeah, the victimization, what a joke. She's a highly overprivileged daughter of an overprivileged man who was also once, unfortunately, the governor of Arkansas. So in briefly, some other news, we are applauding the legislative protection of abortion rights in Minnesota that happened, I think that was last week, Dan, but it's still cause for applause, which is the adoption of the Protect Reproductive Options Act that's going to ensure that Minnesota's existing protections on abortion rights hold, no matter what Who sits on their future state? Courts, it was a great victory, but it was a close one. We're also applauding the Alabama School District in Opelika that halted Bible distribution at its graduations. And when we come back, we're going to talk with FFRF attorney Chris Line about his many victories for separation of church and state, and also he's in an article in the Wisconsin State Journal where they're calling him the running man. And then we're going to speak with Jonathan Larson, managing editor of the Young Turks, about his wonderful investigations into the National Prayer Breakfast.
We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Barker. I'm still alive.
You barely sound like it. And I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we have in studio with us, and we're pleased to say, Chris Line, who is an intake attorney who writes hundreds and hundreds of letters of complaint and gets hundreds and hundreds of victories for the separation of church and state for FFRF since you've joined our staff. Mm-hmm. And Chris, we invited you on for two reasons. First, you're a big celebrity today. There is a big piece complete with photographs of you in the Wisconsin State Journal, the Madison, Wisconsin Daily, headlined Running Man, a constant in downtown Madison, once 444 pounds, now he's down to 180. There's pictures of you looking very svelte and trim outside, and so congratulations.
Thank you.
That's pretty cool. And then we're also going to talk about your very good blog about why he doesn't get me, that Jesus ad that's going to be on the Super Bowl. So tell us more about this article.
Yeah. So, as you know, I lost a lot of weight over the past few years. In fact, it's been a couple of years since it happened. That's what's kind of weird about this is that nothing's really changed over the past 2 years. I've been around the same weight, but it got some attention recently because I was out running. And these two reporters stopped me. They were eating dinner. They stopped me. I talked to them for maybe an hour and a half. One of them told the other that, you know, she has to write about me. This was a couple months ago. And now that's come to fruition. And this article's come out about sort of my running, my weight loss. FFRF gets a shout out in there a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, it does. Thank you. So you think you were as high as 440 pounds and when
yep.
you graduated from law school?
Yep. I think the highest I ever saw on the scale was maybe like 420, but scales just don't go that high. So I'm just kind of extrapolating based on the fact that I gained more weight than that, that it probably would have been around 450.
And so you have really been dedicated. We have seen the weight just fall off you and drop away. And you have tried to keep healthy doing this, correct?
Yep. And, you know, my journey actually started in earnest June 1st, 2017, the exact day I started as a full-time employee at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So it's exactly correlated. Wow. When I first started, I probably lost 15 pounds a month for the first 24 months or something, just very steady. So it was very quick. I mean, I'd say within 2.5 years, 3 years, I had lost the majority of the weight. And it's really been more maintenance and just focusing on health more than weight loss over the past couple of years.
And I think that originally you were out walking for an hour during the lunch hour. You were walking a lot. And then I guess it was your colleagues on our legal floor that challenged you to enter a mini marathon?
I wouldn't say a challenge, but yeah, they wanted to sort of celebrate what I had done. It didn't really make sense to take me out to lunch or something. That seemed kind of counterintuitive. Yeah. So I think Sam had actually led the charge, but they all kind of chipped in to have me participate in the Madison half marathon. At that time, I was barely running, maybe a block or two here or there, but I certainly was not running with any frequency. So it was a kind of a change for me.
And how'd you do?
I did pretty well. I ran faster than I thought I would. I ran faster than my typical pace. So I did, you kind of, the momentum of all the people around you kind of pushes you to go a little faster than you would just out casually running.
You didn't come in last?
I did not, which happened to me a lot as a child, you know, mile runs and things. I was typically the last person. So it was nice to have the athleticism, the lower weight to be able to keep up.
Sometimes when I walk home from work, I see you running down the library mall, but you're always kind of focused. You never look up and smile, but isn't that because you're listening to podcasts?
Yeah, that's an important part. I mean, not only am I able to keep my physical health up, but my mental health, I guess. I listen to a lot of podcasts, 40, 50 hours a week. Free Thought Radio, this show I listen to.
Yes, I know.
I'm
you
out
gave
there.
Us a shout out.
A
Thank
couple
you.
Of their atheist shows, a lot of legal podcasts, current events. You know, it really is double fold for me because I'm able to get the physical activity my body needs while getting the information my mind needs to stay strong.
So you'll be listening to this show next week. So say hello to yourself.
Yeah, I don't always listen when I'm on it, but if I'm not on it, I always listen. And
well, we still have Jonathan Larson coming up.
Okay, I'll have to
He'll
listen
be worth
to
listening to.
He's good, yeah.
And you said your favorites include Pod, Save America. So, but it's my, I couldn't see it. It seems a little extreme. When you're doing your most exercise, what are you doing?
Well, it's not really that extreme. I mean, I break it up quite a bit. I also run very slowly. That's, I think,
so
important
jog.
To know that people don't, yeah, it's more of a jog. Running sounds cooler, though, so I say running. But, yeah, it's more of a jog pace, very slow and steady. It does not exert me at all. Like, so I, for example, could basically jog an unlimited amount. I'm not exerting
myself. But you say you're sometimes it's 5 miles before work.
Yep, I'll do 5 miles in the morning, typically 5 miles at lunch if I'm working from home, and then 5 to 10 miles after work.
That's a lot,
day.
But I hear you have worked in a girlfriend now.
Yep, and so sometimes I'm not able to run as much, but that's fine
you
with
got,
me.
I think so. That balance is important. Yep. But I do think we should also say that your nickname, the Running Man, comes from homeless people and on State Street. And
yep, I've had a bunch of them refer to me as Running Man multiple. I don't know if they just all on their own figured that out, but multiple people have said it. As I've told people before, I'd say over the past 5 years, probably now 40 or 50 people have stopped me. And either at first it was a lot more about noticing my weight loss and saying, oh, hey, I saw you when you were out walking here, like 450 pounds, and now you're out running at a much smaller weight. But more recently, it's been people who just see me running and consider me an inspiration and say, in fact, one guy told me that he thinks about me every time he goes out and runs, or it is sort of his motivation.
Well, it is really an amazing story, and your perseverance and willpower and whatever is like right up there at 100.
Yeah.
So I think everyone recognizes that. But now we only have about a minute left. Can you tell us why he doesn't get us? You wrote a very good blog, which I encourage everyone to go to, Free Thought. It's freethoughtnow.org, and read Chris's blog about this Jesus commercial, but tell us briefly.
Yeah, so I watch football, so I've been seeing these ads. They're also on Reddit. I have a hard time imagining anyone hasn't seen them. They'll do like an ad about Jesus and some aspect of Jesus that tries to relate him to other people. Like, Jesus was a refugee. Jesus fought racial justice. Yeah. He was an immigrant. You know, things like
do
that.
Do they say Jesus was LGBTQ?
No, they don't. They avoid a lot of issues like that. Obviously, they don't tackle abortion. They don't tackle anti-LGBT stuff, which makes sense because the people behind this are actually hardline religious right-wing nuts.
So you show the documentation of who's really behind these
ads.
Yeah,
you can see who funded this. It was a lot of Christian organizations, but they spent money to try to clean up the impression of Christians around the world. So don't be fooled by these ads, I guess, is the main takeaway of the
book. We're out of time, Chris. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Find time to read his very good blog, very interesting blog about it.
Stay tuned for Jonathan Larson, managing editor of The Young Turks.
We're going to talk about all of his wonderful work exposing the prayer breakfast.
Hi, I'm Don Ardell, a life member of FFRF and promoter of Real Wellness Lifestyles. I'm no longer willing to say, in God I trust, so help me God, God bless America, or pretend America is more under a God than any other nation. Join the resistance to Christian nationalism and politicians more attentive to what they think God wants than the needs of their constituents. Let's make separation of church and state a reality and turn back the drift to theocracy. Support FFRF. Our freedom really does depend on freethinkers.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio. I can't say it deep like Buzz today because of this head cold. Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we have on the phone with us an amazing investigative journalist, Jonathan Larson. And we're going to talk with Jonathan about his investigative reportage on the National Prayer Breakfast and how he helped to kind of bring that down as we know it in Congress. But before I introduce him, I do think he has an amazing resume, and I want to impress you. So he was notably an executive producer who created Up with Chris Hayes. Prior to that, he worked for many years on Countdown with Keith Olbermann. He broke several national stories, including insider accounts on the Bush Office of Faith-Based Initiatives and the politicization that went on there. He has been with Al Jazeera America, and as a senior executive producer for politics, he oversaw the Inside Story, hosted by Ray Suarez. Earlier in his career, he's worked on several CNN programs, helping to launch and create Anderson Cooper 360 and Greenfield at Large. He contributed to CNN's coverage of the 9/11 attacks, reporting on that group of passengers on Flight 93 voting to attack the hijackers. And something that is of special interest to Dan and myself, and that is that he helped launch Air America Radio, creating and running several programs, including Morning Sedition, starring Mark Maron, and The Rachel Maddow Show. And of course, that's a special meaning because Freethought Radio used to be part of Air America. So thank you so much, Jonathan Larson, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for that intro. I'm going to clip that and just carry that around and play it on my phone when I meet people.
And now you are the managing editor of The Young Turks.
That's correct, yes.
And The Young Turks go by TYT these days, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think the main show, they have a lot of shows that people can check out, but I think the main show, the one that's been around forever, is still called The Young Turks, I think. I'll get in trouble if that's wrong, but yeah, everyone, I think, pretty much calls it TYT these days.
So you're the managing editor and executive producer, and so Jonathan Larson, we have been agog with admiration for your reporting, the dogged reporting, the diligence, what you've uncovered about the National Prayer Breakfast. You've been doing this for several years, and this year it really had taken seed. And I think we'd just like you to tell us sort of the story of how you got interested in it and what you've uncovered and what's happened.
Sure. Well, first of all, that's very kind of you to say. I appreciate that. Thank you. So the interest in the National Prayer Breakfast and the Fellowship Foundation, which runs it, aka the family, which Jeff Charlotte wrote about. It wasn't sort of an obvious thing on my radar that I thought I want to find out more about that. But I believe it was after the Maria Butina stuff came out.
Yeah, that's about 4 years ago.
Maybe even longer. Possibly 5 years now. I'm not sure offhand, to be honest. But we started looking at Ken Klippenstein, who's now at The Intercept. He was working with us at the time. And we started looking at some of the lobbying, some of the Ukraine lobbying connections. And we noticed that we saw the family was paying for congressional trips of primarily Republican members of Congress heading overseas to various Eastern European countries. And they were taking meetings with a number of sketchy people. And so we did a few reports along those lines. And I believe it was in early 2021, although I could have the year wrong. It might have been 2020. But at some point around then, I acquired internal documents of the families, detailing information that had never been made public before, willingly or otherwise. Basically, it was lists of who was invited to the National Prayer Breakfast. And very importantly, it also included names of the people who submitted those guests to attend. And as I'm sure you and much of your audience is aware, the National Prayer Breakfast for decades has been put forward as if it is a creation of Congress or the president or some combination thereof. And so having the names of the family insiders who were actually making up the guest list allowed us, one, to sort of blow up the fiction that it was anything other than a private enterprise. And two, allowed us to start making an X-ray, if you will, or a map of what the actual organization looked like. It told us who the insiders were. It listed what their relationships were to the family or to members, insiders of the family. It told us who was submitting, you know, dozens of names, right, as opposed to who only submitted one name. So we could see, for instance, that members of Congress were almost entirely absent from the list of submitters. So it wasn't actually Congress deciding who goes. There were a handful, like a single digits, to be sure, of members of Congress who submitted a significant number of guests. And then there were, you know, maybe 10 or 20 more who would submit one or two other guests. But the entire guest list of something like almost 4,000 people was overwhelmingly put together by insiders of the family, unelected folks, unaccountable, identities secret to the public, no one vetting who they brought in there or who they connected with whom. And so by creating a kind of a sprawling number of Google Docs tracking and organizing all this information, we began to be able to tease out patterns and see how some of these relationships had developed over time. And by doing so, track what effect the family was able to have on individuals, institutions, on countries, and so on and so forth. And so I would say probably some of the biggest stories that we were able to break doing so was we were able to show how the family, specifically using the National Prayer Breakfast and some of its top insiders, were instrumental players in turning MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell from sort of like a non-political, very casually he didn't give a lot of thought to his Christianity. He was sort of like, you know, Christian on paper, but didn't think about it a lot. Using events at the prayer breakfast, including the main speeches, including these side events that are not publicized, they're not televised, but we were able to sort of connect the dots between some of the things Lindell has said publicly in interviews, in his book. We were able to sort of stitch together and identify some of the people who he did not name in his public accounts, but we were able to identify, oh, this is this family insider. Oh, this is this family ally. Talk to some of them, confirm some of the details, and basically put together a picture of how over 2 years, they turned him from the guy I just described into the Mike Lindell we all know now. And so that was one of the big stories we did. We also showed how they were involved in network building with right-wing anti-LGBTQ plus political figures in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. And
who were some of them calling for the death penalty for being gay?
That was Uganda. That was Uganda.
But they were tied with them too, weren't they?
There might have been some. Oh, you mean the family one?
Yeah. The family was
100%. That was actually probably the biggest revelation to come out of Jeff Charlotte's work back in 2008. Around then was the family's connection to the Ugandan legislators who were pushing legislation that would have done exactly what you just said, Annie Laurie. And actually, we reported last year that the 2022 Uganda National Prayer Breakfast was a pretty open rally against Western pressure not to discriminate against and to oppress LGBTQ plus people. They didn't really hide it very much at all, the fact that that's what the prayer breakfast was being used to do.
And didn't you break that the primary or one of the major secret backers of the breakfast was the evangelical Franklin Graham?
Yeah, that's right. I'm blanking now. I think it might have been something like $50,000 a year, which went to sort of like the event itself goes runs on essentially the registration fees, but you don't want to have to run any kind of ongoing effort just based on the potentially volatile amounts of money that you get when you open it up for tickets. So Graham kind of provided that buffer every year, including doing so through his organizations. So some tax records were able to confirm that, and I also had a source close to the family tell me that Graham was actually like the only person donating money to keep the breakfast afloat. So yeah, that was one of ours that came out of that, because we could see in the list all the people from, you know, Samaritan's Purse, the Billy Graham Evangelical Association, the Graham family members. You know, they were all getting their waffles and their pancakes.
So this is some of the backstory. When we come back, Jonathan Larson, we want to talk to you about the changes this year. We have talked about them briefly on Free Thought Radio, but we want to get the inside scoop from you, what's going on. And you certainly had some of that information I couldn't find anywhere else about the board members of the New National Prayer Breakfast. So we'll be right back with Free Thought Radio.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are speaking with Jonathan Larson, who's the managing editor and executive producer of TYT, and has done amazing investigative work on the fellowship that or family group, this nefarious shadowy group that runs the National Prayer Breakfast until recently, and the split off, and much of this because of your reporting, Jonathan. So let's pick up where we left off about what just broke and what's the meaning of it, and tell us the inside scoop.
So basically what happened was, we found out with just a few days until the breakfast itself, we found out that the breakfast, two big things happened. One is that the breakfast is now being held in two specific components, right? There's one on Capitol Hill, which is attended just by White House officials and members of Congress, and each of those political guests can bring one guest, either a spouse or a constituent from their district, which is obviously an attempt to make it a more intimate event, which has the effect, of course, of insulating it from all of the people that the family for decades has brought to the prayer breakfast, at least in part, in order to make those political connections. So making those connections now is at least somewhat logistically a little tougher. Meanwhile, at the Washington Hilton, the family and its guests, fewer of them, still met for their own prayer breakfast, only this time they were watching Biden on TV like the rest of us. The other schism you're referring to is that the breakfast that's now being held on Capitol Hill is no longer being run by the legal entity known as the Fellowship Foundation, aka the family. It's now being run by a new nonprofit called the National Prayer Breakfast Foundation. And the reporting that we did basically showed, let me put it this way, there are 10 board members, and I recognized 9 out of 10 names, and it took me about 5 minutes to confirm that the 10th was also connected to the family. So literally every single person on the board is connected to the family.
And yes, and you broke that, you broke the story and broke all of that connection. And then tell us what happened to Mark Pryor, the former member of Congress, a Democrat who is running the new National Prayer Breakfast Foundation, got quite a drubbing from the family for talking to you. Can you tell us the story?
Yeah, sure. So there's a number of former members of Congress on the new Prayer Breakfast Foundation board. Mark Pryor, the former senator you just mentioned, he's the president. Zach Womp, former Tennessee Republican member of Congress, he's also on the board. He's actually the guy who's been running the breakfast for the last however many years internally at the family. So he's absolutely a family insider. And basically what happened was I had a discussion with Mark Pryor. He was gracious enough to give me an interview for an hour. And he said a lot of things, which I think should actually prove heartening to advocacy, advocates of you know, protecting secular government, including pledging transparency and accountability around the new board and how it operates, all of which were things that I thought, you know, were certainly appropriate and should have made critics of the breakfast happy or, you know, as at least a step in the right direction. One of the things he said was he disputed when I told him that I was aware of, that I had information suggesting that every single member of the board, the new board, was connected to the family. He essentially disputed that. And so I gathered everything I had after the interview, not everything I had. I gathered a lot of the material I had and I emailed it to Pryor and I CC'd roughly half the board members to let them know I'm planning on reporting this and I would like to get your comment on the material that I'm attaching, demonstrating the connections to the family that former Senator Pryor has essentially, you know, kind of tried to suggest were not the case. And what appears to have happened is that Womp wrote an email telling Pryor not to answer me. And it appears that Womp neglected to take me off the reply all. And so the board members and I and Pryor all got to see his email, which I then reported on the TYT website. And I can read you the whole thing if you want, or I can talk about any of the specifics in there that you want to focus on.
Well, let's get the summary of it.
So basically he tells Pryor, do not talk to these people. And he basically implies that he talked to Pryor before Pryor spoke to me then as well, saying, he says, quote, I made it very clear you would be wise to not speak to this group, and then calls us snakes and says they aren't honorable. So it's very unfair to you and us, you know, to keep talking to TYT. But also, interestingly, he seems to confirm that the premise of my request for comment, which was that the connection to the family is still there. Womp says the fellowship members are already upset about Senator Coons's comments because Coons said members of Congress had questions about the funding and about who was going there that he, Coons, couldn't answer. And this is, Coons is an insider at the family or the closest thing the Democrats have. So here's Womp saying the fellowship members are upset about Coons saying this and what they see as defaming of the co-legacy. The new group is just throwing us under the bus, he said, the fellowship says. And of course, if you're actually a legitimately separate nonprofit organization, you don't care what the family thinks. Right? That's not on your priority list. Running the prayer breakfast is. And he specifically says more stories and more slander will only lead to more division. Well, I thought division was what you guys were selling us. Weren't you telling us that there is a division here? And now you're telling us there shouldn't be any and there's already been too much. So which is it, folks? So it essentially confirmed that the connections are there. They're active, they're vibrant, they're communicating, and the new board cares what the fellowship, which is largely them, thinks about this new endeavor. So there's definitely still tensions going on in terms of how this thing is going to be run. And I think it's kind of remarkable that you have Zach Womp, a Republican, basically bullying a Democrat to get in line on this stuff. You know, it's basically unity on our terms or not at all.
And so, of course, some of the Democrats were starting to pull out, including notably last year, Nancy Pelosi. The Freedom From Religion Foundation called on members of Congress not to attend in the last several years. And then we did a joint letter that the Young Turks kindly did publicize, too, which I think did have a big impact. But so going forward, maybe what we should end the show with for those who are listeners who don't know what the fellowship is, could you briefly, like we've got about 2 minutes, go into who they are or what we know about them?
I'll do my best. So it's basically a very loosely knit, almost casual organization of Christians, predominantly evangelical Christians, who don't actually have like some sinister master plan, but their ethos is to enable their members and their associates to develop and foster connections with people in power and to minister to people in power in countries around the world. So the fellowship sort of acts as like a clearinghouse to help and administrate the ministry, quote unquote ministry, of these various folks who are developing relationships with people in power around the world. And sometimes it does good. The State Department appears to have leaned on them at times to help make diplomatic progress. And as I reported regarding Guatemala, sometimes it's used to very bad ends. In that case, for instance, the family ended up helping build a political network there that destroyed a UN anti-corruption task force in order to protect a potentially corrupt evangelical president there, Jimmy Morales. So it's not as strategic as a lot of people seem to think, but it's also not as benign as I think they think.
Did I hear you say that most of the family's funding comes from the prayer breakfast?
No. I apologize if that's what I said. The money I was talking about was only regarding the prayer breakfast. So the prayer breakfast gets its fees, and then it gets $50,000 from Franklin Graham. But the family and its operations are distinct from those finances. And we've known in the past that GOP mega donor billionaire Ronnie Cameron, who's a poultry magnate, he has given millions of dollars to the family. But a lot of the family funds, if you look at the IRS website, it shows up at roughly a $10 million a year operation. But a lot of those funds are not going to the central operation of it. What they are is they have dozens of quote-unquote associates doing ministry work, again, quote-unquote, around the world. And those folks, they raise their own funds from their own patrons to sustain their ministry. But that's sort of funneled through the financial mechanisms of the family, which administers things like healthcare plans and things like that. So most of their budget actually probably is just sort of the agglomeration of all of these individual associates and ministers around the world.
Well, we are out of time, but all of your articles can be found online. Jonathan Larsen with L-A-R-S-E-N at T-Y-T, the Young Turks. And congratulations on your reportage, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
And we want to thank listeners to Free Thought Radio in Philadelphia to WOOM, in Bryn Mawr to WZML, Madison, Wisconsin, WIDE and WMUU, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, College Station, Texas, KEOS, San Marcos, Texas, KZSM, Columbia, Missouri, KOPN, Eugene, Oregon, KEPW, Bellows Falls, Vermont, WOOL, Kingston, Rhode Island, University Station, WRIU, and in Ithaca, New York, in Watkins Glen, WRFI. If you listen to the podcast, please give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell everyone you know to learn more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
Support Free Thought Radio by becoming a member. You can go to our website, ffrf.org, and you'll join us in our important state church litigation and become part of the largest Free Thought Association in North America. You can also request information on our website. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.